delivers, but the sweetness with which he delivers the Torah, that is so much appreciated, and so it's real supposed to host you here this evening. Without further ado, it's my honor and privilege to call upon Rabbi Tyra.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Phil. So it's just so inspiring to come and to see on a Thursday night some people coming to learn, and especially people coming to learn in their work clothing. So yes, you hear the Shalach Lefan of Goshna. So Chazal were aware that even our Avos, before the Rabbeinu Shalom, revealed his will to us in a formal sense, and Torah became a normative responsibility. The search and the thirst for the Dvar Hashem was something which was still very compelling, even to our Avos. And it was inconceivable that they should establish a toehold in Mitzrayim before Yehuda was dispatched to, not just, of course, to prepare the material framework, but also to prepare the spiritual framework. So, Baruch Hashem, it's a schus. I also was surprised last night that this is the first shiur being given under the new structure or framework created in memory of Dr. Yitzchak Belazon by his son, Dr. Avi. I had the schus to know Dr. Belazon very well. And he was a person that could have been a Rosh Hashiva if he had decided, but he was so instrumental in converting North New Jersey into a center of Torah. And I have to say, Reb Phil, I've taken a tremendous amount of joy watching you develop into such an influential force, an inspirational figure. I feel a little learned in Gush, but I still have had a very nice relationship with him, and I felt that part of a relationship is a Rav who's a little older than you, always encouraging you and trying to advance you and give you support. Very much Dr. Belazon played that role for me. He wasn't a Rav, but he was a big Torah supporter, and he was always having a sefer, and he married, his wife was the sister of someone I was very friendly with in Flatbush, a friend of my parents. He would spend a lot of Yom Tov in Flatbush together with me, and as a young, aspiring rabbi, and behind every successful rabbi, there's a history of doubt and uncertainty, and can I make it, and should I make it? And to have these figures that come into our lives and affirm our vision and ratify these dreams and reinforce these aspirations, they're very instrumental. So I feel a tremendous debt of gratitude. It's really an honor for me to have been participating in this year. So I also have to apologize because Rep. Phil and I were sending some quick emails, and he said, well, what should I give Shir on? I said, well, can you tell a white lie, and should you lie, and can you lie? And I said, it's Parshas Vayechi, and I was in the middle of 100 different things, and I forgot that it's Parshas Vayechi. So this is a shir. But Torah has eternal relevance. It doesn't require any framework. So it's a question that relates primarily to Parshas Vayechi in terms of the textual framework, but obviously has a larger relevance. The issue itself comes to the fore in a very interesting debate between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, a well-known Gemara, and hopefully if time allows, we'll try to trace it to the general dichotomy between Beis Hillel's way of thinking and Beis Shammai's way of thinking. The Gemara says, source number two, Ksivos Tana Rabbanan, Ketzan Meraktin Lifnei Hakala, we all know the song, this is the source of the song. And evidently in their day and in their framework, rejoicing, augmenting the joy, entailed not just dancing and eating and gift-giving, but also complimenting verbally the kala. In our context, it's less acceptable. It would be perhaps even a little bit inappropriate for a non-relative male to approach the kala and comment on her physical appearance other than just some generic, oh, you look beautiful, you look shiny. But in their context, remember, their mores of sexuality was very different. So in their context, it was perfectly appropriate and expected for male guests, even non-relatives, to approach the kala and say something complimentary about her physical appearance. Well, what happens if the kala isn't that attractive? For attractive kalas, that challenge is relatively easily dispatched. But what about for kalas who aren't physically attractive? That's the setting of this interesting debate between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. So Beis Shammai takes the absolute position. Line number two, source two, Beis Shammai, Omrim kala kimoshihi. You say it as it is. The hardcore, raw, unedited, offensive truth. Kala kimoshi. The truth is, there are some Rishonim who temper this. You don't actually inform her that she's unattractive. You say something generic, or you say something perhaps tangential. So according to some Rishonim, you say, well, you've got a great sense of humor, or your family looks wonderful tonight. But we all know that that's a backhanded insult. For those football fans out there, you know, when they refer to a draft bust, the wide receiver, he's got good downfield blocking. And that's a backhanded way of saying he couldn't catch a pass if it hit him in the numbers. So that would be an insult. So to tell a Kala on the night of her wedding, you've got a good sense of humor, or the chopped liver is very tasty, would be a backhanded insult. According to some interpretations, kimo shehi, you just say the words, kimo shehi, you are what you are. Either way, you don't fabricate the truth. You either call her unattractive, you sidestep the issue, you say something generic, but at some level, you cause an effect. Socially awkward and personally insulting. To which Beis Hillel responds, Beis Hillel Orim, of course we know the song rules like Beis Hillel, Kala Nava Chasid. He commented upon what according to most positions is her physical beauty. Some alter this as well, but at least for this evening, Shira, let's assume that Beis Hillel is willing to endorse a lie to protect the sensitivities of the Kala. Well-known machlokas, Beis Shammai, Beis Hillel. What I'd like to do is briefly demonstrate how Talmudic analysis, what we call lambdas, dissects and deconstructs machlokas in general through the prism of this particular machlokas. So I'm very fond of asking Talmudim and Shir, just as a starting point methodologically, which position do you feel is intuitively most obvious? Because you all know the next question. If Abaye is intuitively more obvious, then what's step two? Give a svara for Rava. And then you'll see the Rishonim develop a svara for Rava. And then, of course, once you build an elaborate svara for Rava, what's step three? Well, what did Abaye say? And you just ping-pong the different logics and svaras until you whittle away and get down to the bone of contention. So, which position do you feel, but don't vote with your hearts, because halacha is an amoral, the system is moral, but the machinery is amoral. Halacha is a legal system. Legally, not morally. I understand your moral sensitivities. But in pure, cold, sterile, legal terms, which position is more riveting? Beis Shammai's position or Beis Hillel's position? You should lie or you shouldn't lie? Absolutely. The last I checked, Yisuri Deraisa can't be suspended for social convenience. So Beis Shammai's position, in pure legal sense, is the intuitive one, is the baseline, which then yields the second part of our methodological analysis. What possible svara could have justified Beis Hillel's ratifying a law? That's our starting point. This is a very effective tool to dissect or to deconstruct machlokes, and at every level. The Rishonim were aware of this, so if the Ritva says, the reason that Rava says what he says, he's assuming that Abaye doesn't need a svara. And Chazal were aware of this also. When the Gemara begins, my time is Tarfon, it's because the Gemara assumed that Rabbi Akiva doesn't need a svara, because it's Pasha. So just training your mind to operate in the way that the Rishonim operated, and the Amarayim operated, isn't just methodologically facilitating, but it also allows you to enter their world and process these ideas the way that our Masara processed it. So having established Beis Shammai as the intuitive position, you're not supposed to lie, it's illegal, what possible svara could Beis Hillel supply? This is precisely the thought process of the Ritva. You take a look at source number 6, the Ritva comments, Perish, dechol shehu mipnei darche shalom, ein bo misho midvar sheker tircha. Namely, as we would call it, according to the Ritva, Beis Hillel endorses an overtally. There's an Isser in Midvar Sheker Tircha, but the prohibition is overtallied by a mitigating circumstance which is more compelling, which is more significant, namely, Darchei Shalom. Darchei Shalom, overtallies covered up Riyos, Darchei Shalom, for purposes of tonight's year, assuming they're the same, Darchei Shalom, covered up Riyos, overtallies the Isser of Sheker. What's the source of Beis Hillel according to the Ritva? The Ritva doesn't quote it, but it's pretty obvious. If you take a look, the back page, source number 11, and this is the tie into Parshas Vayechi. I said Rabbi Goldberg, I got confused. I was running, I thought this is Parshas Vayechi. The Gemara says, Amarev Ilah, Mishum Rebbe Lazar Reb Shimon, Mutar Lo Le'adam L'shanos V'Dvar Shalom. You can fib, you can alter the truth for the purposes of harmony and good relations, based on Parshas Vayechi, where Yosef's brothers present him with their father's deathbed wish that all the brothers should harmonize, when of course Yaakov didn't instruct this because they fear the consequences of continued strife and dissent. Ko tziva avicha kosim ruli Yosef, And of course, the Gemara says, Gadol HaShalom, the second to last line, Shafa Kadosh Baruch Hu Shinaba Demei Karak Siv Vadonizake. Sarah laughs and scoffs at Avram's sterility. And when HaKadosh Baruch Hu presents Avram with this news, he presents it as if Sarah were doubting her own fertility, not Avram's fertility. So presumably the Gemara and Yavamel serves as the source for Beis Hillel, at least in the shidduch that the Ritva creates. The Ritva creates a shidduch between Yavamos and Beis Hillel. He doesn't articulate it, but it's implied in the Ritva statement. So step one was identifying Beis Shammai as the baseline physician, as the Nisr Sheker. Step two consisted of giving a svar for Beis Hillel. So what's step three? Now that we've established such a wonderful, elaborate svar for Beis Hillel, what if Beis Shammai disagree? You can't disagree with the Gemara and Yavamos. So we ping-pong it. If I had a blackboard, we'd be ping-ponging the pressure from one Tana to the other, in this case from one group of Tanaim, Beis Hillel, to Beis Shammai. So if there's a Gemara in Yavamos that doesn't just ratify or allow fibbing for the purposes of harmony and good relations, it actually commands it, mitzvah l'shanos, gadol l'shalom, afak v'kadosh baruch hu, so Beis Hillel Shita is much more compelling. What does Beis Shammai claim? Presumably, the Rishonim don't really address this. This is an interesting lacuna. It's an interesting black hole. The Rishonim don't really fully elaborate this. The Achronim fill in the blanks. Presumably, Beis Shammai would counter as follows. If you look carefully at the Gemara and Yavamos, no lies are being told. Truth is being shaded. What's the key word in Yavamos? Mutter l'shanos. It doesn't say mutter l'shakir. Mutter l'shanos. Certainly in the situation of Avram and Sarah, Sarah scoffed at each of their fertility, or each of their sterility. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu merely omitted her laughing at her husband and provided the details of her laughing at him. In the case of Yaakov, he may not have commanded it explicitly, but he may have assumed it, he may have desired it. It's not black and white, it's not binary, it's not on and off. You're allowed to shade the truth. You're allowed to exaggerate the truth. You're allowed to withhold information. That validation is actionable and is displayed by the Gemara and Yavamos. But a lie? To approach a college is physically unattractive and more attractive than Yavamos is. Midbar Sheker too. Said otherwise, in more halachically classic terms, Kavod HaBrios overtallies Isiri DeRabbanan. Kavod HaBrios can never, ever overtally Isiri DeRaisa. This is based on the Gemara in Brachos, source number 7. Gadol Kavod HaBrios Shedoche Lo Taseh Shevataro. The Gemara presumes that Kavod HaBrios should overtally even an Isser, and the Gemara is aghast. Lema Ein Chachma Ein Tfuna Ein Eitzel Neged Hashem. He says, no, that's not what we meant. Kavod HaBrios can't overwhelm an Isser Deraisa. Isser Deraisa are immutable, inflexible. Time autonomous, context autonomous, nothing to do with the context. You can never violate an Issa Deraisa. Remember that a couple of years ago they had this picture that went viral of the Kohen on the plane with the bag over his head? So everyone was scoffing and ridiculing. So I put out a share on the internet, and the basic gist was every Orthodox Jew has that bag moment. Every Orthodox Jew has to reach that moment. It may not be the bag over the head, where you stand tall and defiant and you maintain halachic integrity in the face of social order. So I wouldn't necessarily, if I were a Kohen, climb on that plane to begin with. Maybe I'd take a different route. Maybe I'd take a boat. But every Orthodox Jew comes to that moment. And that's one of the litmus tests of Orthodoxy. Are you willing to suffer social indignity for the sake of halachic compliance and halachic fidelity? So there's no question that a Kavod HaBrios factor can't overwhelm an Issa Deraisa. And the Gemara makes the adjustments. Last line of source 7, Komili derabbanon. What the Gemara really meant were rabbinic. And this is, by the way, very important for life today in Israel. Very often I'll show up somewhere and I'm not sure about the kashrus and I'm not sure about the... And I'm not sure this Gemara is sufficiently educated. You should never eat isser, you should never eat treif. But it's a question of relaxing your chumrah. I personally, in my home, I'm not going only to eat glot and red meat in Eretz Yisrael because the shechita levels are more... I go to someone's house and I'm going to insult them because of my chumrah. Is that a chumrah? That's a kula. I'm being naked and coming to brios. So it's something that has to be kept in mind. Again, you shouldn't draw broad conclusions, but by and large, Isiri Derabbanan should be suspended in chumrah or coming to brios. You may not want to place yourself in that context to begin with, but certainly Isura D'Oraisa are inflexible and inviolate. So Shammai would say the sheker in Yevamos, that's shaving the truth. At most, it's only the Asur Midrabanan, maybe not even, but let's say maximally is Asur Midrabanan. That's valid. Lying Dirabanan, and this is Rabanan, can be tolerated for the sake of Darchei Shalom. But an absolute lie, telling an unattractive Kala that she's attractive, that's Asur Minatara. And therefore, the Isur can't be suspended. So Beis Shammai's response to Beis Hillel would be Yevamos is irrelevant to Ksivos. Yevamos speaks about an Issa Derabanan of Sheker, which is shading the truth. Ksivos describes an Issa Deraisa of Sheker, which is inflexible. So now the question is, having defended Beis Shammai and differentiated between the alteration of truth in Yevamos and the outright lying Ksivos, so what's the next question? What's Beis Hillel respond? Beis Hillel has to accept the Gemara in Brachos. He also has to accept the reality that Dirabanans can be overtallied, but Dirisas can't be overtallied. So presumably Beis Hillel would respond as follows, and here we actually have Rav. Is the Sheker in Ksuvos actually Asur Min HaTorah? Why should the Sheker in Ksuvos also only be Dirabanan and therefore vulnerable to a Kavod Abrios overtallied? What makes the Sheker in Ksuvos unique? What? Well, that we'll get to. They might not be sheker, but let's assume it's sheker. It's not harmful. It's not deleterious. It's not antagonistic. When the Torah describes the Isser sheker, take a look at source number one. Very interesting juxtaposition. Nidvar sheker tirchak, v'naki v'tzadik al taharok. Avoid lying and don't harm others. Don't murder, don't harm. Perhaps the only lies that are forbidden min HaTorah are those lies that are harmful, that are deceiving, deceitful, deceptive, that are injurious, that are manipulative. This lie is flattering, is attempting to augment the simcha. This is actually the response for Beis Hillel found in a variant source. Very often it's helpful to witness Gemaros in their original sources, because Gemaros are compendiums and anthologies. The source, or one of the parallel sources for this debate between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, is quoted in Maseches Kala Rabasi. Maseches Kala Rabasi is one of the minor tractates. Chazal never developed it into a full-blown Gemara. These Mishnayos never went through the filtration process of Maseches Prophet from Sefer Rabasi. These are raw, early Mishnayos. But listening to the way Maseches Kala Rabasi records the Machlokas suggests this approach for Beis Hillel. Source number 9. Ubeis Hillel Amr, here's the addition that's absent from the Gemara in Sukkos. Ubeis Hillel Amr, line 3. Ki Amar Rachmana Midvar Sheker Tirchak Mishum V'naki V'tzadik. Only because it's harmful, harmful Sheker is Asur Min HaTorah and can't be overtallied by Kavod Abrios. Ksuvos is harmful sheker. Halakiyume, but if the sheker is supportive, is what we would call reinforcing, what we would call building character, halakiyume, shapir dami. Namely, Beis Hillel's response to Beis Shammai is Ksuvos really does resemble Yevamos. Just like Yevamos is only asur midrabanan because it's shading the truth and it can be overtelling for Kavod Abrios, Ksuvos is also, the sheker in Ksuvos is also only asur midrabanan, because it isn't damaging and therefore can be overtalled. Interestingly enough, this position was staked by Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah didn't quote Beis Hillel. Rabbeinu Yonah, as you know, was a cousin of the Ramban. He was also a mechutan of the Ramban. At some point, I think the Ramban's son married Rabbeinu Yonah's daughter. Rabbeinu Yonah was known, of course, for the Sefer Shaarei Teshuvah, Rabbeinu Yonah Kadosh Migarandi from Spain. Many people claim that the Shaarei Teshuvah was written as personal penitence, because Rabbeinu Yonah was one of the leading opponents of the Rambam. He led the crusade against the Rambam. The big, big controversy of the 12th century was the Rambam's writings. The Radak, the Ramban, everyone clocked it. Rabbeinu David Kimche, Rabbeinu Moshe Ben Nachman. He led the anti-Rambam front, leading to the burning of the Rambam Svarim in France, ultimately leading to the burning of Shasim in France, that we read about on Tisha B'Av and in Marami Rottenberg's Kin of Shali Sufa Ba'esh, many people feel that after witnessing the burning of Shasin, he had such regret that he wrote the Sefer Sha'arei Tshuva as a personal penitence. One of the leading figures. Unfortunately, most of his writings haven't survived. One of the great ironies of history. Most of the Rambam's writings have survived. The Ben Yonah's writings, we have little tidbits. We have the Sefer, of course, the Sha'arei Tshuva. We have a Sefer written by his Talmidim on Bava Basra and on Brachos. One of the great ironies that he was so militant against the publication of the Rambam, his Svarim didn't make the historical cut, even though we have record of him teaching and learning with his Talmidim the entire range of Shas. So in the Sefer Sha'arei Tshuva, he writes source number 10, B'sipur dvarim asher yishmo, if he just tells stories, exaggerations, Haggadot Me'aros, line number 2, Yachlifu dvarim alodos chafzeim, it just changed the truth, Me'ein hefzed li'adam, but you don't cause any damage. Amru Rabboseinu, line number 4, Kigamza. So that's also the drop off. So he doesn't connect to Beis Hillel, but that seems to be Beis Hillel's logic. So let's follow the trail. It'd be easier if you had some visuals, but Beis Shammai, if you follow my hands, Beis Shammai claims that Sheker is immutable. Beis Hillel invokes Kavod Abrios, based on Yevamos. Beis Shammai says, well, Kavod Abrios can overtali this is Rabbanan, but can't overtali this is Deraisa, to which Beis Hillel says, who says the Sheker in Ksuvos is really Asur Min HaTorah? You're not harming anyone. So now what's the next step? Having defended Beis Hillel, the Sheker in Ksuvos isn't harmful, and therefore isn't Asur Min HaTorah. So let's see if you can provide two options for Beis Shammai. What are Beis Shammai's two options in defending his position that you can't lie in Ksuvos? Either he holds what? That all Sheker is Asur Min HaTorah. And that's the bone of contention. This position of Rabbeinu Yonah is Beis Hillel's baseline, but Beis Shammai argues. Beis Shammai claims harmful sheker, innocent sheker, supportive sheker. Sheker is toxic, has to be avoided. The fact that the Torah articulates mitzvah sheker tirkos v'nakivis tzadik al tarok, notwithstanding, sheker is an independent autonomous issue. And now we've reached the baseline. That's the machlokes. What are the parameters of sheker ben adam? And of course, Chazal didn't speak this way. They spoke in code. They knew Shach so well, so they talked about kalanah v'chasuda and the kalanah. What they really meant was how to define the parameters of sheker. When Chazal wanted to speak, that's why outside of the Gemara, view Gemara as idiosyncratic and picayune and arbitrary and silly, it hurts me when I say so. I'm going to have logic in the world, you know, make fun of them on Facebook or something, you know, if you shouldn't be sleepers. It's very harmful to see that. Chazal knew Gemara so well, they just came in and held out test cases that encapsulated the background logic. So when one is talking about possession, and in terms of possession, Shai Malchus and the Dallas. Two people were fighting over a tunnel. They weren't talking about two people. They could care less about the palace. They were discussing possession, how do you define possession, what happens when there's conflicting possession. They spoke in codes. Same if I say touchdown, you know exactly it's 7 points with an extra point and 100 yards. And if I landed in Johannesburg, if there were touchdown, they wouldn't know what I'm talking about. Because you're so conversant. So when Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel engaged in that debate that day in the Beis Medrash, what was really pulsing was, what are the parameters of Sheker Deraisa? Beis Shammai felt that all Sheker is Asur Deraisa, even a harmless Sheker. And therefore, you can't overtally Asur Deraisa Sheker, even harmless. And Beis Hillel countered by claiming that only harmful Sheker, and not even Tzadik El Taro, is Asur Min HaTorah and immutable. Likewise, as we would say, innocent sheker, supportive sheker, is only a civic rabbanon and falls within the parameters of Yevamos and can be overcome. That's one option for Beis Shammai. What's another option for Beis Shammai? Beis Shammai agrees that only harmful sheker is Asur Min HaTorah. But Ksuvos is harmful sheker. What makes Ksuvos harmful sheker? You're not hurting anyone. Who are you injuring in Ksuvos? What? Well, other people. Okay, I don't necessarily care about you. Who are you harming? The husband. How are you harming the husband? You're presenting or you're posturing in ways that aren't authentic. What does halacha call inauthentic fraudulent posturing? If I invite you, the Gemara in Chulin says, I invite you to my house for a meal, and I've just opened a new keg of wine for my family, then you walk in and say, welcome to my home, I just opened a new bottle of wine for you, an important guest. What is that an Isra? There's a question about it. No, but there's certainly an Isra Kedavis Das. So Beis Shammai may have countered to him, you're right! Only harmful sheker is Asur Min HaTorah. Harmless sheker is only Midrabanan. Who says that Ksuvos is harmless sheker? It's harmless to the wife, but it may be harmful to the husband. And if it's harmful to the husband, then it's sheker d'oraisa, Shammai would say. And if it's sheker d'oraisa, it can't be overdone with the cover of Rios, and the law can't be taken. This position, in understanding Beis Shammai, was staked by an interesting Talmud of Rabbeinu Tam. In fact, one of the top three Talmudim of Rabbeinu Tam, known as Rabbi Eliezer of Metz, the French town of Metz, 12th century, Reb Chaim Kohn, Reb Shimshon, and Reb Eliezer Metz, all learned with Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam was one of the game changers. He taught, let me put it into your context, I asked a boy today, I know his father's not here, so I won't be embarrassing him, who is the greatest inspiration in your life, religiously? I loved his answer. He said, Rabbi Bati Yosef, because he's learned all of Yalkut Yosef. Could you imagine having a room of 80 Rabbi Bati Yosefs? Well, that's exactly who Rabbeinu Tam taught. There were 80 Baalei Atosos at one moment sitting in this great academy in France, learning from Rabbi Yaakov Ishtar, Rashi's grandson. And it's amazing to think, as we spoke about France before, when Rashi grew up in France in the 11th century, there was no Torah in France. Zero. He had to travel to Germany to study with German rabbis. He studied in Germany, returns to France, and he and his grandchildren convert France into a center of Torah for hundreds of years. So people really do make a difference. And I'm not here to speak about my Rebbe, I don't have that much time, but to me, one of the amazing accomplishments of Liechtenstein, and I think Americans feel about loss, so to speak, that he emigrated from America, but he radically transformed the Hesder world. The Hesder world today has over 85 yeshivas, and Rav Liechtenstein infused that world with the Lithuanian ethic that was previously missing. The Hesder process was being given by Rav Kutzman, and they had their own masala and their own approach, and Rav Liechtenstein added Rav Soloveitchik and the Lithuanian model and the Volozhinov school. Some yeshivas adopted it more than others, but had Rav Liechtenstein not moved to Israel, that whole infusion would never have occurred. So he was really a game changer also, in ways that hopefully we'll continue to realize as the years evolve. So one of Rabbeinu Yaakov Tam's Talmidim was Rabbeinu Eliezer of Metz, who wrote a Sefer of Mitzvot called Sefer Yireyim. This is a list of mitzvahs. I don't have time to describe what makes the Sefer so riveting. It's an interesting Sefer of Mitzvot. But let's take a quick look. Just source number 8, last line, top of the back side. He says, Midvar Sheker Tirchak, second to last line, source 8, Hahi, the Sheker of Ksuvos, Yeshbo Ra Labrios, is harmful, Shammai says. Kidivre Be Shammai, Shenira Kigonev Dasaba. If this is true, then the bone of contention between Shammai and Hillel was not about the parameters of which Sheker is Asher and Katara. Everyone agrees only harmful Sheker is Asher, but how do you define harm? Beis Hillel said only harm which are causing some material monetary insult or damage. And it's not. So there's no harm. Donos of Elkaro, as you go bottom, to be overdeveloped through government rules. Whereas Beis Shammai felt that even non-monetary harm, deceit, manipulation, exploitation, psychological exploitation, causing the husband to look at me in a certain vein, that's also considered harm, rendering the Sheker Asur Min HaTorah and inflexible to the overdeveloped government rules. So, by following this trail of analyzing the machlokas, we've reached two very different conclusions as to the machlokas Shammai. Either they argue about the parameters of the sheker d'oraisa, it's all sheker asa, Shammai, even harm the sheker. Hillel felt that only Beis Hillel, only harmful sheker, and Ksuvos isn't harmful, and therefore can be overdone. Or, they all bought in, as they would say, to the reality that only harmful sheker is asa, they just debated how do you define harmful sheker. Shammai claimed that any harm is considered harmful sheker, is a violation of the Torah, and can be violated. That's just one way to view the sukkah. You can imagine this large tree expanding. Because that, follow my hand without a board, that presumes that Beis Hillel's Heter allowance was based on the overtally theory. Remember we started 25 minutes ago, covered up Rios overtallies, Sheker based on Yevamos, and that led us into a discussion of the nature of the overtally in Drabat and Deraisa. There's an entirely different way to view the Machlok Shammai and Hillel, and someone said it before. Let's see if I can tease it. Beis Hillel doesn't allow the lie in Ksuvos because you're overtallying the Isser with covered up Rios. Beis Hillel claims it's not an overtally, but it is a, like I said it before, complimenting the kallah on her looks, not a lie, because beauty is subjective. Not that it's a lie and an overtally, and I've got to work out the mechanics of when and where to overtally. Maybe Beis Hillel felt that by stepping into the mind frame of the husband for once a year, ignore your own view and step into, there's one person in that room who finds this kala view, at least one, hopefully the father of two kalas, take a title. Hopefully the father, but also the husband. So when the husband finds this really beautiful, and part of your chiyav, your responsibility this night is to see things from his standpoint. So this whole debate about overtally and when and deraisa, it's just one strategy. A totally different strategy is to presume that Hillel didn't view this compliment as a lie, because beauty is subjective. We don't have many Rishonim who articulate this clearly. I have one, but I'm saving it. But let's first read the continuation of the Gemara.
Didn't you get into a lot of trouble every time something was subjective, but not because of
lying? Lying is always a slippery slope. Whether it's an overtally or a subjective, it's always a slippery slope. Yes, which is part of his Shammai's obstinacy. Someone once said, I once read, I think it was Eric Hoffer, or someone said, when you lie, you walk into a territory and something, you lose your passport for return. It's a slippery slope, and you start lying and justifying and chronic lying, and all every lie is a justification, and then ultimately you lose your passport to return to the land of truth. But let's see the continuation of this discussion in Ksuvos. After the legal claims have been rendered, Beis Hillel defends his position with a parable. Very interesting. Beis Hillel becomes a Hasidic Rebbe. Amar lehem Beis Hillel Beis Shammai. Source 2, three lines in the bottom. L'divreichem, I'll prove my point. Listen to Beis Hillel attempting to prove his point. L'divreichem, mishalakach mekach ram min ashok. Let's say your neighbor comes home and purchases a lemon. Remember those cars? What were those cars called in the 70s that exploded on impact? The Honda. What?
The Pintos.
Right, the Pintos or some other.
Gremlins.
Yeah, the Gremlin, right? Yeah. Your friend buys a Gremlin. That's a little younger. These were cars in the 80s or 70s. They're real lemons. Yeah. Your friend buys a lemon. Buys a Pinto or a Gremlin. What should you say? Yishab Chenubainov? Two lines in the bottom of source 2. You should compliment him. Oh, you got an innovator. Well, you should insult him. Tell him the truth. You bought a lemon. Here they go. We should praise him. We should praise him. What is Beis Hillel accomplishing by citing this parable? See, giving another example of one. I'm opposed to one. You haven't added more compelling logic by citing the parable of the marketplace. We had a debate. Should you lie to an unattractive man? Shammai felt no, for whatever reason. Hillel felt yes, for possibly this reason or some other reason. And Hillel wants to support his claim because he broke the marketplace. I deny that as well.
Why Hillel is quoting the marketplace analogy is the market thrives on subjectivity. If there were absolute values, there wouldn't be a market. One person's lemon is another person's treasure. One person's trash is another person's trophy. That's why there's a marketplace. That's why people trade. That's why there's commerce. Russia has an excess of oil or potatoes, and in some other frigid country there aren't, so they exchange. Potatoes are worthless in Russia, but the market is driven by subjective needs. Obviously, psychology of the market, subjective needs. So when I flatter or compliment your purchase, I'm basically responding to market subjectivity. And it's obvious that it isn't the lie, because if you purchase something, you have some value, psychological or commercial or financial. So the market obviously conveys the subjectivity of truth and need. So if the marketplace is driven by subjectivity, Hillel reasons, then so is beauty driven by subjectivity. And that's how he augments his claim. By invoking the market, he's establishing an arena in which subjectivity is clearly the driving force and comparing human beauty. And if you look carefully at the way this concludes, Mikan Amru Chachamim, second to last line, source 2, this is Hillel's final statement, Liolam te daita shalada mi'urevis im habrios. What does that mean, mi'urevis im habrios? We typically interpret that line that you should be easygoing, socially interactive, people involved in community, mi'urevis im habrios. If that were true, it may not have such relevance in this Gemara. Like how Rashi interprets, I hope I forwarded the Rashi, I put this together very quickly. Rashi, source number 13, Tehidaito shel Adam me'urebes im habrios lasos le'ish v'ish kirtzono. Quotes the pasuk in Megillas Esther. Lasos le'ish v'ish kirtzono. Which may mean to be able to appreciate needs of others which are different from your needs, or in this case, attractiveness of others or attraction for others which are different from attraction for you. So by adding this final line and by invoking the marketplace analogy, Hillel may have been developing, they still are a completely different strategy. The first strategy speaks of overtally. It's a lie. Kavod Abrios is docha. There's an overtally. What are the exact details of one Isser being nitcha for a heter of Kavod Abrios? And we develop that along the lines of Yevamos, Sheker Diaraisa. A completely different view of this today, and potentially fascinating view, and I'll elaborate just for a few minutes on is that they weren't engaged in the legalese of whether which Isser can be set aside through which heter. They're more involved in a conceptual issue. Is beauty objective, in which case this would be a lie? Or is beauty subjective, in which case this would be a lie? And a section. What I find so attractive about that second approach is it jives with the general patterns of Hillel and Shammai. So many of their debates were along this crease, along this fault line of two different ways to view the world, through ideal lenses or through practical lenses. Right? Let's face it, the Haredim are right. In Gan Eden, no work, no wars, no diseases, no doctors, no lawyers. We all sit and learn Torah. When Mashiach comes, no wars, no doctors, no lawyers, no Tikkun Olam, no state to run. We'll all sit and interact with HaKadosh Baruch Hu through purely spiritual field or spiritual interfaces. The question is, what happens when you live in a fallen world? You try to superimpose that primordial ideal upon an unaccommodating world, which is more or less the Haredi approach. I'll let the chips fall where they may. Someone will worry about the army, someone will worry about the police force. Let others worry. We'll pursue this ideal ethic. Or do you try to redeem the world and address the world through practical means at great cost to that spiritual person? That debate is essentially shallow on many different fronts. Let me give you a classic example. Beger, Marn Shabbos. The convert approaches Shammai and requests to be converted al regala, 15 minutes of conversion. 15 minute conversion, McDonald's drive through conversion. Shammai is appalled. People spend years, lifetimes studying Torah, discovering the mystery of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, committing Avodas Hashem. You think it's a quick, facile, immediate transformation? So Shammai shows him the door. Shammai evicts him. Hillel lives in a real world. And in Hillel's real world, not the ideal world, but Shammai's right, really. Ideally, that's how you trivialize Torah and Judaism in 15 minutes. But Hillel realizes that those who seek the Dvar Hashem and are interested in conversion may have to receive Judaism packaged differently in a shorter, abbreviated version. So it offers in the famous, do unto others as you do unto yourself, idach zil gemar, and the rest you'll come to. Ethics and morality is the baseline of religion, and you'll be able to extrapolate the rest. This is a classic clash, where Shammai is adopting the hardline, ideal position, the way things should be, and Hillel is responding to the fallen reality. People will see conversion in inauthentic, unfortunately. Another Mishnah that many people aren't aware of is a Mishnah in Avos. Remember the first Mishnah in the Sechas Avos? What are the three things at that first Mishnah? Have a Mesudim Madin, Asir siyad latara, vehamid lo tamidim hape. Be deliberate in the way you judge, asir madin, humros, asir siyad latara, hamid lo tamidim hape. So Beis Shammai said, in order to be accepted into Shammai's yeshiva, you're listening? I gave an interview, so there's two more minutes in. Shammai had four requirements for acceptance. You have to be humble, you have to be wealthy, you have to be wise, and you have to be pedigreed. Anav, Chacham, Ashir, Umiyuchas. The Mishnah in the end of Perak Beis of Avos Dvarnasi. And Beis Shammai is absolutely right, because if you're not wealthy, you'll prostitute Torah for financial gain. And if you're not humble, you'll self-aggrandize. And if you're not wise, you'll distort. And if you're not pedigreed, you'll study Torah in a vacuum rather than in context. Sing Torah in your home. So Beis Shammai's absolutely, how dare you teach Torah to people who will warp or pervert its beauty? How many Talmidim do you think attended Shammai's yeshiva? And Beis Hillel said, Lakol yomah Torah shahar bei poshim hayu b'Yisrael v'chzir na Torah l'mitav. The Chassidish approach. And Shammai said, Hillel said, teacher, this is a classic offset between idealism and pragmatism. Seeing the world the way it should be and actually confronting the way the world is. Which is why we postulate like Beis Hillel. Because we live in a fallen world, and a fallen world demands practical concessions. The danger of concessions, listen carefully, because we live in this world, is that today's concessions become tomorrow's aspiration. And we constantly reduce our baseline, and we are constantly dancing a moral limbo against lower and lower. Because we make a concession, then that becomes the ambition. And then the next concession becomes the next goal, and we lose sight of the way things really should be. Which is why Chazal tell us, I haven't ever found a medrash, not by said before, you know, but it's a masara. Somewhere I found it, that Bimos HaMashiach will pass like B'Shammai. Because Bimos HaMashiach will live in a perfect world. And we'll have the ability to pass like Beis Shammai. But in a fallen world, in a perfect world, you walk into the wedding and the kala is unattractive and you say, you look very ugly tonight. And she says, thank you, welcome to the wedding. Enjoy the smorgasbord. I'm not interested in marrying you. In our fallen world, the sensitivity, the emotional vulnerability, that can be very insulting. But in a world beyond beauty and beyond care, that may not be insulting. So this whole question of whether to view beauty objectively, feel objective as Shammai, person to be defined as beautiful or not in objective terms. We just finished Chanukah, the book that he used to tell us how to be fun, and it wasn't about the individual, but it's about the platonic ideal. You're not a poor, you're just an expression of some platonic man, and decentralizing of human work. And myself, you know, in a real world, in our world, beauty is subjective. That's a very, very quick assessment, but these are the tools. And if you possess these tools, you can approach any subject in that methodology. Take a machlokas at any level. Tanayim, Amarayim, Yishonim, Machronim. Identify the simple position, and then try to build logic to defend the less intuitive position, and then just keep ping-ponging the process until you're able to arrive at that core issue. They argued about this. They argued, and then check back with the text and see which position is more textually grounded, which position is less textually grounded. Here we've had two approaches. One is they argued about overtelling and Isser, and what parameters allow the overtelling. Or they argued about the definition of beauty. Beis Shammai viewing it as objective. Beis Hillel, some people intuited it. And after developing this, you can actually find it in the show. If you look carefully enough, you can make a definition from the Kubetzes, but it's not as clear as we would like it to be in this case. Again, Yashabach to everyone, Yashabach to the Rabbanim, and Shabbos everyone. We should have a lot of Torah for this program, which is starting.
Thank you. I want to thank Rabbi Chagrin so much for graciously sharing his Torah with us this evening. It's a small insight into how to teach not only Torah, but methodology. Look forward to the opportunity to learn from you for many years. Did we get a Marav already? So if we have a Marav living here, we're wishing them for all the great ones. Thank you.
Thank you.